When Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow hit bookshelves in 2010, it detonated like a bomb in America's consciousness. Endorsed by Cornel West as the secular Bible for a new social movement, it quickly became required reading in universities, churches, and community centers across the nation. The book has sold over 1 million copies, been cited in numerous Supreme Court decisions, and fundamentally changed how we discuss race and criminal justice in America. Even celebrities like John Legend and Jay-Z have referenced its ideas in their advocacy work. What makes this book so powerful is not just its meticulous research, but its devastating central argument. America hasn't ended racial caste. We've merely redesigned it through mass incarceration. Throughout American history, racial caste systems have demonstrated remarkable resilience, repeatedly collapsing only to be reborn in new, more sophisticated forms. After slavery's abolition in 1865, a brief period of progress during Reconstruction saw African Americans elected to state legislatures and Congress, and the establishment of black schools and businesses. However, this progress was systematically dismantled by Jim Crow laws, enforced through both legal mechanisms and terroristic violence, including thousands of lynchings between 1877 and 1950. When civil rights victories finally dismantled legal segregation in the 1960s, a new system of control emerged through mass incarceration and the war on drugs. This transformation exemplifies what legal scholar Reva Siegel terms preservation through transformation, the way white privilege maintains itself by adopting new rules and rhetoric while producing similar discriminatory results. Each iteration becomes more sophisticated and harder to challenge legally, though less comprehensive in its ability to control the entire race. The pattern follows a predictable cycle. After each system's collapse comes a period of transition where proponents of racial hierarchy devise new control mechanisms. These systems typically exploit lower-class white vulnerability and economic anxiety, creating coalitions based on racial solidarity rather than class interests. In the post-Civil War South, poor whites were granted special privileges and positions as slave patrollers. After Jim Crow, they were promised protection from economic competition and social integration. The current system began taking shape in the 1970s when conservative strategists developed a law and order approach centered on racially coded appeals. Nixon's administration was remarkably frank about this strategy in private. H.R. Haldeman recorded in his diary Nixon's emphasis that the whole problem is really the blacks, while seeking a system that recognized this without appearing to. John Ehrlichman later admitted their 1968 campaign strategy was explicitly designed to target racial fears, stating, "We'll go after the racists." By 1982, Reagan dramatically escalated this approach by declaring a war on drugs, despite less than 2% of Americans viewing drugs as the nation's most important issue. Federal law enforcement budgets soared from $8 million to $95 million in just 3 years, while treatment and prevention funding was slashed. The administration launched a comprehensive media offensive sensationalizing crack cocaine in inner cities, with the help of hundreds of press conferences and a publicity tour of seized drug paraphernalia. The timing of this war was particularly devastating for African American communities already reeling from deindustrialization. The economic collapse of inner cities in the early 1980s had created an unprecedented crisis, with industrial employment of black men plummeting from 70% in 1970 to just 28% by 1987. Major urban centers saw the disappearance of manufacturing jobs just as the crack epidemic hit. Rather than addressing this economic devastation with investment, education, and opportunity, America responded with an unprecedented expansion of surveillance, policing, and incarceration, creating a new racial caste system through the criminal justice system. The war on drugs operates with few meaningful legal constraints on police power. The Supreme Court has systematically dismantled Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable searches and seizures, allowing police to stop, interrogate, and search citizens without warrants or probable cause. In Florida versus Bostick, the court ruled that police could approach passengers on buses and request to search their belongings without any suspicion of wrongdoing, calling these consensual encounters rather than seizures requiring constitutional protection. The court determined that a reasonable person would feel free to refuse police questions or searches, ignoring the reality that most people feel comply with police requests. Beyond consent searches, police employ pretext stops as another favorite tool. Traffic stops motivated not by traffic enforcement, but by a desire to hunt for drugs without evidence of drug activity. The Supreme Court gave these stops its full blessing in Wren v. Brown, ruling that an officer's true motivations are irrelevant under the Fourth Amendment, even though this amendment was specifically adopted to prevent arbitrary stops and searches. The federal government fuels this system through massive financial incentives. The Edward Byrne Memorial Program, established in 1988, offered federal grants to agencies prioritizing drug enforcement. These funds created narcotics task forces nationwide, with some states directing up to 90% of Byrne grants to specialized drug units. The Pentagon donated military equipment and intelligence, transforming the rhetorical war into a literal one. Within a decade, paramilitary SWAT teams became commonplace tools for serving routine drug warrants. The statistics are staggering, from just a few hundred paramilitary drug raids annually in 1972 to 40,000 by 2001. These militarized raids are violent encounters. Officers blast into homes, typically at night, throwing grenades and pointing weapons at everyone inside, including children. The Reagan administration provided another powerful financial incentive. Departments could keep the majority of cash and assets seized during drug operations. This 1984 amendment to federal forfeiture laws created a revolution in policing priorities. Suddenly, departments could substantially increase their budgets by taking property from suspected drug users or dealers, even without criminal charges or convictions. Once arrested, people's chances of ever truly escaping the system are minimal. Defendants, particularly those from disadvantaged backgrounds, are typically denied meaningful legal representation, pressured by threats of lengthy sentences into plea bargains, then placed under formal control through incarceration or supervision. This creates a cycle that is nearly impossible to break, especially for those without financial resources. Though the Supreme Court ruled in Gideon v. Wainwright that poor people accused of serious crimes are entitled to counsel, the nation's public defender system is woefully inadequate. Defenders routinely carry impossible caseloads of over 100 clients simultaneously, often juggling 100 to 200 cases at any given time. In some jurisdictions, public defenders spend an average of just 7 minutes per case before court. The American Bar Association concluded in 2004 that the fundamental right to a lawyer effectively does not exist in practice for countless people across the United States. This crisis has only worsened, with some public defender offices reporting that their attorneys handle more than 400 cases annually, nearly triple the recommended maximum. Almost no one ever goes to trial. Approximately 97% of federal cases and 94% of state cases end in plea bargains. Though not widely known, prosecutors are the most powerful officials in the criminal justice system. They can dismiss cases for any reason, overcharge defendants with more crimes than can realistically be proven, and effectively determine sentences through charging decisions. This discretionary power often goes unchecked, with prosecutors facing little oversight or accountability for their decisions. The pressure to plead guilty has increased exponentially since the war on drugs began. In 1986, Congress passed the Anti-Drug Abuse Act, establishing extremely long mandatory minimum sentences for low-level drug offenses, typically 5 or 10 years for first-time offenders, compared to 6 months or less in other developed countries. For instance, possession of 5 grams of crack cocaine triggered the same 5-year mandatory minimum as 500 grams of powder cocaine, creating 100-to-1 sentencing disparity that disproportionately affected minority communities. These mandatory minimums transfer enormous power to prosecutors, who can force guilty pleas by threatening decades in prison. A typical scenario might involve a prosecutor charging a defendant with multiple felonies carrying a potential 30-year sentence, then offering a plea deal for 5 years. Prosecutors routinely load up defendants with charges carrying harsh sentences to force pleas to lesser offenses. While impossible to know precisely how many innocent people plead guilty out of fear, reliable estimates suggest 2-5% of prisoners are innocent, translating to 40,000 to 100,000 wrongfully incarcerated individuals. Studies of exonerations have shown that over 10% of proven wrongful convictions involved false guilty pleas, highlighting how the system's pressure can lead even innocent people to admit to crimes they didn't commit. Most people assume our prison population exploded due to rising crime rates, but it was actually changes in laws and sentencing policies that drove our prison population from 350,000 to 2.3 million. One study suggests the entire increase from 1980 to 2001 can be explained by sentencing policy changes alone. But this system of control depends more on the prison label than prison time itself. Once branded a felon, a person enters a parallel universe where discrimination and exclusion become perfectly legal, and basic citizenship rights like voting vanish. Most people labeled felons never even go to prison. As of 2018, there were 2.3 million people in prisons and jails, but 5.1 million under community correctional supervision. The felony record becomes a permanent badge of inferiority. Drug felons are barred from public housing, discriminated against by landlords, denied food stamps, forced to disclose their conviction on job applications, and excluded from countless professions. Permanently locked out of mainstream society and economy, most find their way back to prison, about 30% within 6 months and 68% within 3 years. For those on probation or parole, risks are even higher. Subject to constant surveillance and additional rules that don't apply to others, they can be searched without cause and arrested for technical violations, like missing appointments or failing drug tests. In 1980, only 1% of prison admissions were parole violators. By 2000, it was 35%, about as many people as were admitted to prison for all reasons in 1980. This creates what sociologist Loic Wacant calls a closed circuit of perpetual marginality. Hundreds of thousands are released yearly, only to find themselves locked out of mainstream society. Most return to prison, sometimes for life. Others are released again, only to find themselves in the same circumstances, unable to overcome their permanent pariah status. The war on drugs has devastated communities of color while largely ignoring similar drug crimes in white communities. In 7 states, African Americans constitute 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison, and in at least 15 states, blacks are admitted to prison on drug charges at rates 20 to 57 times greater than whites. Despite the fact that people of all races use and sell illegal drugs at remarkably similar rates, with studies often showing higher rates of drug use and dealing among white youth, 3/4 of all people imprisoned for drug offenses have been black or Latino. Government data from 2000 showed white students using cocaine, crack, and heroin at 7 to 8 times the rate of black students, and white youth were more than a third more likely to have sold illegal drugs than African American youth. Drug law enforcement fundamentally differs from other types of law enforcement because drug crimes are consensual activities with no clear victim calling the police. With drug use so widespread, more than 1 in 10 Americans violate drug laws annually, police must make strategic choices about whom to target. These choices inevitably reflect the racial imagery promoted by political and media campaigns. The Reagan administration's media blitz featuring black crack users and dealers in ghetto communities reframed drug use from a public health issue to a grave threat requiring war. This created an us-against-them narrative, with us being white suburban America and them being black Americans. This racialized framing became so powerful that by 1995, a survey revealed 95% of respondents pictured a black person when asked to envision a drug user, though African Americans constituted only 15% of actual users. Law enforcement officials, exposed to the same racially charged rhetoric, developed both conscious and unconscious biases. Despite the obvious risk of racial bias in the drug war, the Supreme Court adopted rules that would maximize rather than minimize discrimination, then closed courthouse doors to racial bias claims. In McCleskey v. Kemp, the court ruled that statistical evidence of systemic racial discrimination wasn't enough. A defendant needed to prove the prosecutor or jury in his specific case acted with racial bias. The court erected this impossibly high standard, knowing that procedural rules shield prosecutors and jurors from such scrutiny. For newly released prisoners, finding housing becomes an immediate, desperate need that can make the difference between successful reintegration and recidivism. Housing discrimination against felons is perfectly legal, a modern echo of Jim Crow's racially restrictive covenants. The 1988 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, strengthened by Clinton's 1996 One Strike and You're Out policy, authorized public housing agencies to automatically exclude drug offenders and other felons. This extends beyond public housing. Private landlords routinely screen out those with criminal records, forcing many ex-offenders into homeless shelters or unstable living arrangements with relatives. Even halfway houses often have strict eligibility requirements and limited capacity. Finding employment presents equally daunting obstacles. The checkbox on applications asking about criminal history creates an often insurmountable barrier, effectively screening out candidates before they can explain their circumstances or rehabilitation. Nearly every state permits employers to discriminate based on convictions, and many allow discrimination based merely on arrests without conviction. Surveys reveal employers' extreme reluctance to hire those with criminal records. While 90% would consider hiring welfare recipients, only 40% would consider ex-offenders. Industries with the most entry-level opportunities, like retail and food service, are often the most resistant to hiring former prisoners. Professional licenses and certifications are frequently denied to those with records, closing off entire career paths. Even those who secure decent jobs discover they cannot survive in the legal economy due to crushing financial obligations imposed upon release. Ex-offenders must make payments to probation departments, courts, and child support enforcement offices while facing fees for drug testing, treatment programs, jail booking, and monthly supervision. These costs can amount to hundreds or thousands of dollars monthly. Though debtor's prison is technically illegal, many states use probation revocation as a debt collection tool. Missing payments can result in reincarceration. Some jurisdictions even charge room and board fees for jail time served. For newly released prisoners who are homeless, unemployed, and debt-burdened, government assistance is largely unavailable. The 1996 welfare reform legislation signed by President Clinton requires states to permanently bar individuals with drug-related felony convictions from receiving federally funded public assistance, including food stamps and TANF benefits. While states can opt out of this provision, as of 2010, only 13 states and D.C. had done so completely. This creates a cruel paradox where those most in need of support to rebuild their lives are categorically denied help. Voter disenfranchisement delivers the ultimate message that former prisoners are not considered full citizens. 48 states prohibit inmates from voting while incarcerated for felonies, with most continuing to withhold voting rights during parole and beyond. Some states impose lifetime bans that can only be reversed through complex clemency processes. This stands in stark contrast to countries like Germany, Norway, and Denmark, where prisoners are encouraged to vote as part of maintaining civic engagement. No other democratic nation disenfranchises released prisoners to the extent America does. An estimated 5.85 million Americans are denied voting rights due to felony convictions, with disproportionate impact on minority communities. Those cycling through America's prisons constitute a new racial undercast, a group defined largely by race and permanently locked out of mainstream society. While there are differences between mass incarceration and Jim Crow, the parallels are striking and profound, creating a modern system of racial control that operates with remarkable efficiency and devastating impact. Both systems share historical origins in white elites exploiting racial resentments of poor whites for political gain. During Jim Crow, segregation laws strategically deflected working-class anger away from economic elites toward blacks. Similarly, the war on drugs employed carefully crafted racially coded rhetoric about crime, urban decay, and welfare queens rather than addressing legitimate economic anxieties of working class whites. Politicians like Barry Goldwater and George Wallace pioneered this law and order rhetoric, which later became central to Republican electoral strategy. The most obvious parallel is legalized discrimination. Today's felony labels subject African Americans to many of the same forms of discrimination that existed under Jim Crow. In employment, studies show job applications with felony convictions receive 50% fewer callbacks, with the effect even more pronounced for African Americans. Housing discrimination manifests through crime-free housing ordinances and widespread screening practices. Public benefits restrictions bar drug felons from food stamps and public housing in many states. Voting rights face severe constraints. In Florida alone, before recent reforms, more than 1 in 5 Black adults could not vote due to felony convictions. Other parallels reveal the system's comprehensive nature. Systematic exclusion from juries occurs through both peremptory strikes disproportionately removing Black jurors and automatic disqualification of felons, creating overwhelmingly white juries in many jurisdictions. The Supreme Court has repeatedly closed courthouse doors to racial bias claims through decisions requiring proof of conscious racial bias, nearly impossible to demonstrate. Extreme racial segregation persists as prisons physically remove Blacks from society while returning ex-offenders to increasingly concentrated and isolated ghetto communities where police surveillance and arrests remain intense. Perhaps most significantly, both systems fundamentally define the meaning of race in America. Just as slavery defined Blackness as being a slave and Jim Crow defined it as being second class, mass incarceration defines Blackness as criminality. The stigma is deeply racial. The term white criminal seems confounding, while Black criminal feels redundant to many Americans. This conflation wasn't accidental, but carefully constructed through media coverage of the war on drugs, which overwhelmingly portrayed drug criminals as Black, despite similar rates of drug use across races. The system thus provides an outlet for expressing anti-Black sentiment in an era when explicit racism is condemned, allowing the perpetuation of racial stereotypes and discrimination under the guise of being tough on crime. The result is a strikingly comprehensive system of racial control that, like its predecessors, operates through law and custom to maintain a racial hierarchy while adapting to contemporary social norms that officially reject racism. Understanding these parallels is crucial for recognizing mass incarceration as more than just a criminal justice issue, but as the latest iteration of America's racial caste system. Colorblindness has proven catastrophic for African Americans. Rather than pursuing colorblindness, we should embrace color consciousness, placing faith in our capacity to show care for others while fully recognizing racial differences. Criminal justice reform efforts alone are futile against the massive scale of mass incarceration. Private prisons represent a powerful economic force. Rich investors have millions at stake in expanding the prisoner population. Beyond private prisons, a vast network of profiteers depends on mass incarceration. Phone companies charging exorbitant rates to prisoners' families, weapons manufacturers, private healthcare providers, military contractors using prison labor, corporations exploiting cheap prison workforce, and politicians building prisons in white rural communities. We must talk openly about race rather than debating crime policy as though it were purely about crime. People must understand mass incarceration's racial history and how economic insecurities and racial resentments have been exploited for political gain. While affirmative action and diversity initiatives are important, racial justice advocates should consider whether they functioned more as racial bribes than tools of justice. These policies may have diverted attention from mass incarceration while perpetuating the myth that anyone can succeed through effort alone. Perhaps the time has come to give up racial bribes and begin an honest conversation about how us can include all of us. This means whites must also sacrifice their racial privileges. If we want to end not just mass incarceration, but the history of racial caste in America, we must lay down racial bribes and join with people of all colors unwilling to wait for change to trickle down, saying to those who would stand in our way, accept all of us or none. Mass incarceration is the new Jim Crow, and dismantling this racial caste system should be the focus of all who care about social justice. The popular narrative celebrating America's triumph over race blinds us to this reality. The new system functions as a gateway into a larger system of racial stigmatization and permanent marginalization, an invisible underworld of legalized discrimination and social exclusion for those labeled criminals. Like Jim Crow before it, the new Jim Crow cannot be dismantled through litigation and policy reform alone. We need a social movement grounded in a new critical consciousness about race. A human rights nightmare is occurring on our watch, and a new social consensus about race must be forged, beginning with dialogue that fosters critical consciousness.